Welcome to Worldview. From WBEZ, I'm Steve Bynum, in this week for Jerome McDonnell. The schools we attend, the taxes we pay, how we vote, the wars we fight, a God in whom we choose to believe or not to believe in. So many essentials in life are dictated to us by borders. With the immigration debate in full swing, many people accuse the other side of believing in open borders.
It seems like a new fad. What do they hope to achieve by calling for the abolition of ICE?
Nobody can figure these people out unless you come to the conclusion that the left wing of the Democratic Party, which controls the Democratic Party, believes in open borders. I mean, they believe in open borders. They believe in letting anybody come in who can come in, flood in millions and millions more.
Open borders?
Open borders.
That's a Koch brothers proposal.
The idea.
Of course. I mean, that's a right-wing proposal, which says essentially there is no United States.
But it would make a lot of global poor richer, wouldn't it?
And it would make everybody in America poor. Then you're doing away with the concept of a nation state.
Democrats want open borders, and I'd respect them more if they would just come out and admit it. It's time for final thoughts. You can't attack, demonize, and call to eliminate ICE, but still maintain you care about the safety and security of our nation. You just can't.
You just heard U.S. Representative Dana Rohrabacher, Senator Bernie Sanders, and political pundit Tommy Lauren. So despite the accusations, we've assembled a panel of people to actually do believe in open borders. Brian Kaplan is professor of economics at George Mason University, and he co-authored the forthcoming book, Open Borders, The Science and Ethics of Immigration. It's a nonfiction graphic novel on the philosophy and social science of immigration. And also with us is Yasmin Nair, an historian and writer. She's editor-at-large of Current Affairs. And joining us shortly will be Zay Garcia Puga. They are a member of the Moratorium to End Deportations campaign, and their latest book is Desirable Undesirables. Welcome all of you to Worldview.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to be here.
Great. I'll grant you this topic is very broad and can easily go off the rails. So today we're going to try to take just a little nibble at one really big question. And that question is, why borders? And we want you to get into the conversation. You in the audience, give us a call at 312-923-9239, post on Facebook, or tweet us at WBEZ Worldview. Okay, Yasmin and Brian, neither of you expected word games when we asked you to join the show, but we're going to get started with some quick word association. So I want you to give me a one-word answer or a series of one-word answers when I say the word border. Brian?
Poverty.
Surveillance.
That's it?
That's how I think of the border, is a zone of constant surveillance, demonizing and brutalizing everyone who lives on either side.
Mm. Brian, why do you think people feel they need borders?
Well, I mean, so basically there's a lot of claims about the bad things that would happen if a lot more people came. And at first glance, I think they make a lot of sense to people. But when you really calm down and crunch the numbers, these claims are just wrong or like really, really the opposite of the truth for the most part.
Yasmin, your thoughts? Why do you think we feel we need borders?
Well, we don't feel we need borders. We've been told we need borders. I'm reminded of the very famous Eddie Izzard little riff that he did many years ago on his comedy tour when he mimed a British soldier going into India and saying, "This is our land." And 300 million Indians looked at them and said, "What do you mean this is your land?" And they said, "Well, we just said it was. You can't do that." And the British soldier's response was, "Do you have a flag?" And the Indian's response was, "No, you gits, we don't. Well, then we own the land because we have a flag and we have some guns behind us, right?" So borders in that sense are, we've been schooled, I think, to think of them nowadays as essential demarcations between quote-unquote ways of life, but they have been chiseled into our consciousness because of long histories of colonialism and, basically various kinds of what we would today call state-sponsored terrorism, right? So it's not that we think we need borders, and what those of us on the left who are thinking and rethinking and against the idea of borders, what we're really trying to get people to do is to think about the history of the notion of the border itself and what all of that comes with, right? So maybe, so I'm really looking forward to today because I hope we can unpack this idea of the border in a historical way.
We're going to give it a shot. Brian, you're a libertarian, and I watched one of your videos where you discussed the concept. And actually, it was very interesting the way you started off because we played a clip of people who accuse others of believing in open borders. But you started off that lecture, and I'm sure many others, by saying what?
Probably started off by saying hardly anyone believes in open borders. It's an unfair caricature of most people. But yeah, I actually do think that it's right, the right way to go.
And what exactly are open borders in your mind?
Yeah, so you know, it's just a system where anyone who wants to live or reside in any country on earth can legally do so. So again, you know, it's different from citizenship for all or anything like that, but you know, it just means that if you want to go and live in the United States or France or Argentina or any other country, you just buy a plane ticket or a boat ticket or a bus ticket and you go there, and there's no law saying that you're not allowed to get a job once you arrive.
And Brian, we'll get into your philosophy as far as migration economics and other issues and what open borders mean to you. But first, Yasmin, if you want to chime in on when you hear the term open borders or what that means to you, is that more of a political statement? Is it more of an economic statement? Is it an existential statement? What do open borders mean to you?
Of the position on the left, a lot of people, when they critique the idea of open borders, and I think this very much is reflected in the clips that you played at the very beginning, right? There's a caricature of the left position on open borders, which is the sort of Shazam moment where we just open the floodgates and let people in. But strictly speaking, what the open borders is a way for us to start thinking about what constitutes a border and what are all the mechanisms that come along with the border. So to simply I would push back against the idea of it being a question about economic migration or simply about, quote-unquote, freedom, right, the freedom to move about, which, by the way, is a wonderful thing and obviously to be pushed for. But it really is about saying, first of all, what is the border and how the border is packed in with a set of mechanisms that are about exclusion and about surveillance and about deciding and defining who gets to be a quote-unquote citizen and who gets to be seen as a productive member of society. So the problem with the economic argument for open borders, for instance, is that it simply defines people in terms of, well, hey, you know, we need more, and this, again, I apologize if this seems like another kind of caricature, but it's basically saying we need more people to clean stuff or to make more computers, so therefore we must have open borders, which leads to prosperity and so on. Whereas those of us on the left who are talking about open borders are saying borders are explicitly linked to methods of criminalization. So for that reason, you know, the economic, open it up to economic migration, that argument is based entirely on the idea that we must let in the good migrants, right? The
right.
Good productive. The word productive comes up quite often. Whereas we would say, let us argue, let us think about who gets to define what is criminal and good and productive. And you consider, for instance, within within the United States, the drug laws, right, have been ramped up over many, many decades to increase the idea of criminalization. And this is why we're now seeing a sort of a swing back in terms of marijuana, which actually itself is implicated in a larger marijuana industry. That's a whole other complicated story. But the point is that thinking about borders in terms of opening or closing them allows us, what we really need to do is to think about what are the structures in place that allow people in and out.
Right.
And what does that then allow us to do in terms of, to put it bluntly, capitalism itself, for instance.
Okay, thank you. So, Brian, you are an economist, and you have a number of perspectives on this, and you can certainly incorporate a response to Yasmin in your answers. But let's sort of run down some of the arguments that you give for open borders, especially from an economic perspective.
Sure. So what Yasmin was talking about is the Shazam view. That basically is my view. I don't want to tie open borders to any kind of philosophy about colonization or anything like that. Think of it as just a very common sense thing of saying that if a person wants to live and work in your country, it's legal for them to do so, and leave it at that. Now, what is the case for that? So, I would begin by saying that philosophically, it seems like it's the kind of thing you would have to justify to say that a person isn't able to live and work where they want. So I'm not saying that's impossible, but I would say there's just a general presumption in favor of people being able to live and work where they want. Mm-hmm. And then that's where I would bring the economics in and saying, well, what are the arguments against allowing that? So, probably the most popular one is the one that you had Bernie Sanders talking about, saying that it's going to cause horrible poverty in the receiving country. And again, here, there's been just a lot of work on what the actual effects are. And the main thing to understand about immigration is that it's a way of moving labor from countries where it is less productive to countries where it's more productive. And, take like a Haitian who moves to Miami. The day he shows up, before he has learned a word of English or anything else, his earnings skyrocket, maybe going from $1 or $2 a day to going to $50 a day or $100 a day. And the reason is because the Haitians' labor is just a lot more productive in the United States than it is back home in Haiti, which, Jen, doesn't have that much to do with him. How productive would you be if you were stuck in Haiti? Right. So, the real economic case, in the case saying that rather than causing poverty, open borders would cause an enormous amount of actual wealth creation, just saying, look, open borders is a way where people are allowed to move their labor from places where it is less productive to places where it's more productive. And again, this doesn't just benefit the migrant, also benefits everyone who consumes all those products. So I have this thought experiment I like. So, imagine you've got 1 million farmers stuck in Antarctica. They're just farming the snow, eking out a bare, meager existence. What happens if you allow those Antarcticans to move to a more hospitable country? And obviously, the Antarcticans are going to be better off. But in the more hospitable country, the more favorable of farming conditions, they grow a lot more food. And what do they do with that food? They sell it. So it winds up benefiting everybody who eats. Now, when economists go and try to measure how much would the production of mankind go up if you were to go and let anyone live anywhere they want, usual number is something like a doubling of the production of the world. So I say, this is not trickle-down economics. This is Niagara Falls economics, just an explosion of wealth that you can get from untrapping labor from unproductive places in the world and allowing it to move to places where it can really fulfill its potential.
Sure. So in later in the show, we're going to get to what are some of the solutions or how to make that happen. But obviously, there is a vested interest in exploiting cheap labor or using borders as a way to exploit cheap labor. And so, Yasmin, if you want to respond to that, you don't have to respond to my comment, but what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. I mean, I'll respond to that briefly by saying that all that does, this business of allowing Haitians, for instance, or Filipinos, for instance, to come into this country, for instance, and send money back to their home countries, all that's doing really is supporting a remittance economy. Right? It's allowing people to simply support the people they left behind at home, their families and so on. And those economies are not necessarily improving, neither are conditions for people in places like Haiti or the Philippines. Those economies are not being boosted. In fact, as we know, major corporations, American corporations, are able to use all kinds of loopholes to use places like Haiti as manufacturing places, right? So, which is why you get your underwear so ridiculously cheap and so on. We all know this. I mean, so that isn't shifting in any way. So I'm not sure what we mean by, productivity and so on, all of that increasing. But I wanted to sort of shift this, all of this, from simply talking about people being able to buy more things, which is a very, which restricts the idea of, dare we say, human potential to having more things. I want to shift that to thinking about the sheer brutality of a world today, that is entirely defined increasingly for masses amount of people by the conditions of forced migration, if we want to call it migration, right, of forced removal, forced, enforced kind of a desperate move to escape. We might even call it moves of escape, right? Sure. That's what's happening. And if you think about Syria, which only a very short time ago in terms of the blip of human history was a strong economy, which is now in complete devastation. If you think about all of that, those are the conditions that we have to think about. And the way to think about those issues, you know, the ways to think about them are not through things like open borders in terms of, say, butterflies moving across borders. And I'm not at all caricaturing Mr. Kaplan's views here. I just want to be clear. I'm talking more actually about the way even some people on the left imagine, right, this idea of open borders. That's not the way to think about it. The way to think about it is colonialism is an integral part of the world as it is constructed.
Sure, sure, great.
Are we not on right now? I hear music.
No, you're on. We're about to take a break. So Yasmin, thank you very much. And we're going to give Brian an opportunity to define specifically what he means by production. But I also want to give the audience an opportunity to jump in on this conversation to ask the question, do we need borders? What would a world look like if it had open borders? So to get into this conversation, give us a call at 312-923-9239. Post us on Facebook with your question or comment, or you can tweet us at WBEZ Worldview. I'm Steve Bynum, and you're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Steve Bynum, in today for Jerome McDonnell. And we're talking about borders. Why do we have them? Do we need them? How do you feel about a world or a society with no borders? Give us a call at 312-923-9239. That's 312-923-9239. You can post us on Facebook, and you can post us at Twitter at WBEZ Worldview. And to help us tackle this ominous question, we have with us Brian Kaplan, professor of economics at George Mason. His forthcoming book, co-authored book, is Open Borders, The Science and Ethics of Immigration. And Yasmin Nair is a freelance writer, historian, and editor-at-large of Current Affairs. And also joining us soon will be Zay Garcia Puga. They are a member of the Moratorium to End Deportations campaign, and they authored the book Desirable Undesirables. So before the break, Brian, Yasmin was talking about the need to pivot from a strictly economics sort of perspective and talk about other factors when thinking about borders. And before you answer that, I did want to link to back to your video, because one of the things that I noticed about the way you gave the answers is that you had a very sort of for lack of a better word, a tone, sort of like, I know what you're going to say, I know what your answers are, I know what you're going to attack me with, but here are the facts, whether you like it or not, and I'm just going to present it and do with it what you will. So first, let's sort of respond to pivoting from necessarily a pure economics perspective about talk about borders and labor, then also talk about some of the types of people and questions you get bombarded with when you talk about having open borders.
Yeah, so I think it's kind of odd to say that I'm only looking at this from an economic point of view. You know, when I say like open borders just means that anyone on earth can live and reside, you know, can reside and work in any country where they want. Of course, one of the main things people are going to do is try to move to get a better job. There's a lot of other motivations that people have for moving. Although it's true, when you see people moving in very large numbers, the most common reason is people are moving to go and get a better job. And what I say about that is that's great, because they are enriching themselves while enriching the world. It's not the kind of thing that you should be afraid of, but rather it's the kind of thing that, you know, should be welcome, not just for the migrant, but for for the rest of the world, to see that labor is not going to waste and people can actually make good use of their skills. I mean, of course, there's other things people want to do. So like one of them is they want to escape war zones. Right. That's one important thing that you might want to do. Another thing is just to bring your family together. Again, when people talk about remittances, of course, a big part of the reason why remittances are so important, sending money, going to work in a country and sending money home, is because it's really hard to get the rest of your family to move with you. So, a lot of what would happen under really open borders is that it wouldn't just be workers that would move. They would move their whole family. And again, if you're wondering, like, so what's going to happen to the sending country? Probably our best experiment we have here is Puerto Rico. So since 1902, the U.S. has had open borders with Puerto Rico. And the result is, first of all, over half of all Puerto Ricans have left. It took a long time, but over the course of decades, most Puerto Ricans now live inside of the 50 U.S. states. But at the same time, Puerto Rico is actually, despite the horrible hurricane, is basically the richest island in the entire Caribbean. So it's not that the people remain behind or doing worse. And again, those remittances is, of course, part of it. But also when people move from Puerto Rico and come to the U.S., they get business connections, they get skills, and they may want to go home and retire in Puerto Rico. So all of these things mean that you get development in the sending country as well as the receiving country, which, again, doesn't mean that's the only important thing, but it is one important thing. And I will say that for the vast majority of people, like, the chance to go and move and get a better job is way more important to them than some philosophy about colonization or something like that. I mean, which, again, is, I think, something that, you probably need a PhD even to understand.
I need to butt in here and say that this is not a philosophy of colonization. Colonization is not something that's difficult to understand, especially if you live in a place like Puerto Rico, and especially if you live in places like the Philippines or India. I think it might be extraordinarily difficult to understand, perhaps, if you are a certain kind of American citizen, but colonization is a brutal reality. It's a never-ending reality for many people across the world, even today. So that is not, I think that's a terribly, dare I say, America-centric view of how colonization works out. And the point about colonization is that it has technically not ended, right? The effects of it are still reverberating across the planet. Now, when it comes to the question of migration, people are not migrating for economic reasons, first of all.
They're not?
There's no such thing.
That's crazy. How can you say they're not migrating for economic reasons?
Will you let me finish and not be such a man? Thank you so much. So economics is intrinsically bound up with the political, right? We are talking about a globe that is a global economy that is in many ways sustained by an interpenetration between the violence of war and the violence of capitalism. In other words, what is driving many economic policies today is the impulse also to carry on certain kinds of forms of domination. That, if you cannot separate that, which is why, to give your audience a very basic example, right? In recent years, over the last decade or so, we have seen a lot of outcry about blood diamonds. Now, I happen to love diamonds, so let's not go there. But the idea about blood diamonds, right, the idea about critiquing and being considerate about where you get your diamond engagement ring from, right, is very much a part of a conversation that has been going on for many years about asking people to think about how this extraordinarily beautiful object is, in fact, constructed as such and also dependent upon the sort of brutalized labor of millions of people we don't see. So in that sense, and I'm not done here, in that sense,
okay,
this idea of, the separating the economic, right, so sort of in such a banal fashion as to make it seem like nothing at all, it completely occludes the reality of what's going on in migration.
Okay, yes, and we're going
to... In terms of migration, what I also want to say here is...
Quickly.
Because I really don't want to get... I don't think it's really worthwhile for this to become simply an argument or a debate between two people. I do want to point to the audience in particular to, I think, an analogy about a situation that many people, even in America, are more cognizant of, which is the prison system, what many of us refer to as the prison industrial complex, a phrase that was not in vogue even 5 years ago.
Okay, so Yasmin, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to jump in, but I'm going to have to allow a guest who just, Zay just walked in the door, and actually this is what he wants to discuss. Zay Garcia Puga is a member of Moratorium to End Deportations Campaign. They are the author of the book Desirable Undesirables, and this is specifically his expertise. And so, Zay, I know you're having some issues getting here, but welcome to Worldview.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so, do you want to chime in on this?
Absolutely.
Where Yasmin was going?
I just, your guest is talking about colonialization like it's some like mythical thing that happened a long time ago that requires a PhD to understand is just ridiculous. We have made several lifelong friendships with the Tohono O'odham Nation. The Tohono O'odham Nation exists just south of what is now Arizona and Flagstaff. And the Tohono O'odham Nation have existed on both sides of what is now the U.S. and Mexico for thousands and thousands of years, and those people are still here. They are some of our very best friends, people like the attorney Nellie Jo David, who specializes in indigenous sovereignty law, people like Shining Soul, people like Nellie Jo David, who we've been working with extensively to combat.
You got to turn your phone off.
I'm so sorry, to combat this thing called comprehensive immigration reform. And what I really want to tell my communities, I myself exist within the deportation continuum because I am a criminal. I have been illegalized by the state, the very state that has sought the destruction of people like the Tohono O'odham Nation. And right now they are battling what is now understood as comprehensive immigration reform. And what I really want your listeners and my community to understand is that comprehensive immigration reform, at its crux, is about geopolitics. It is about militarization. It is about billions upon billions of dollars for Israeli apartheid companies like Elbit Systems, like G4S, like Microsoft. We have to fundamentally understand that these are indigenous lands. Mexico is a colony, in as much as the United States is a colony. These colonial systems have insidious ways of destroying us to this day. And like I said, I really fundamentally want our community to understand that there are a lot of powerful, nonprofit immigrant rights lobbies that work in conjunction with the Democratic Party so long as they respect the Republican and the Democratic consensus to militarize the southern border. Because, I mean, and that's a whole topic in and of its own. I mean, how is comprehensive immigration reform actually a way for the American empire to establish its domain, its sovereignty at a time when global regimes are fraying?
And we're going to bring that back into our larger discussion of borders. And give us a call at 312-923-9239, 312-923-9239. We're going to give Brian an opportunity to respond to all of this. But first, we're going to talk to Russ. Russ, you're on Worldview.
Hi. Open borders implies a fluidity of people moving when they want, where they want, in any number they want. But eventually, when people go to where they want to go, they establish themselves, they form communities, they pay taxes, they get services, they get comfortable, they have children, they build schools, et cetera, et cetera. And the fluidity at some point stops. And they say, okay, I like it here. This is good. Now I want to defend it. So my question is, how do you take care of that healthy tension between people who want to move somewhere and those who did move here however many years ago and now have established themselves and said, I went through this. I want this. This is mine. How do you work through that?
Okay, so we're going to give Brian an opportunity to answer that question first, and if he wants to have a response to the last few minutes.
Yeah, so I mean, this is the kind of problem that really solves itself. Primarily by when you have your kids, they go and grow up in their new country and they acculturate to the new country. Of course, parents do that to some extent. But again, this is the kind of thing that happened for the entire largely open borders period of U.S. history. It still happens today. If you want to get an idea about how much assimilation is going on, I always ask people to just ask an immigrant parent. And they'll tell you, I can't believe how much my kid has been Americanized by being here. So, I don't think this is really too much of a concern. In terms of, responses, I really appreciate the work of anyone who is working against deportations. And, it's terrible that a person who's would actually be illegal just for going and living their lives.
Yes, I just want to make it clear that we work against all deportations, regardless of whether someone has been deemed worthy or not worthy.
Yeah, of course. Well, again, that's that is the open borders idea, is anyone is free to live and work where they want. I would say I just think that it's a big mistake to go and try to tie a common sense idea like letting people live and work where they want to any larger philosophy of history, to any big theory about how the world works. So I think it's a common sense idea, and I think it's best just to go and tell people the idea instead of telling them to accept a general view of
the world.
I think
it's best that you stop being condescending towards indigenous people and allow them the opportunity to articulate their resilience that's ongoing. I mean, it's centuries long. These people have not disappeared. Right now, I am at NPR Studios along the lakefront. This is still Potawatomi land. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, again, I don't see what this really has to do with the conversation.
I'm telling you that those treaties still exist. Those treaties still exist. The burgeoning American colony and, you know, the burgeoning elites of the Potawatomi people here in Chicago promised the Potawatomi the land that these studios are on. That is not in the past. That is ongoing, and we can take up that claim.
Right, but again, I don't see this as much to do with open borders, which is the topic here.
Well, then it has everything to do with the fact that your borders are abstract fictions that are actually just enforced through terror. So when you want to talk about Midwestern American values, what do you mean? This like concentration camp logic that we're undergoing?
Yeah, I mean, again, so you did miss the first part of the show, but like I'm completely on Sarah's side on this matter. Like I agree that these the borders are enforced through violence and that they're wrong. But again, I'm just saying that I think you should, you know, it's better to just focus on that and talk about what are the likely effects if borders are relaxed or opened rather than tell people your general philosophy.
I have to say, this is such a fantasy land that I'm looking at here. You know, this wonderful fairy tale about how people just move across borders and establish families. And there's absolutely no trauma anywhere. There's nothing. People just move across borders, set up homes and bodegas and shops and so on, and live happily ever after. But, you know, this is...
Well, there's plenty of trauma. I never suggest they didn't, you know, so...
There's a history of colonization. I live on the South Side. There's a history of colonization on the South Side. And it's not just, it's not only Native American, the colonization of Native American people, but it is about the enforced sort of busing, the enforced redistribution of bodies in Chicago, which is itself a form of colonization. Anyone who lives on the South Side has a fundamental understanding of that. Now, they may not discuss it in the terms that you think are perhaps more applicable, I don't know, but everybody understands the brutality of history, of historical relationships in Chicago alone. Just living in the city, we understand it. So to kind of, you know, diffuse all of this into a kind of fantasy about people just move because they want a better life. Well, first of all, that completely ignores what is happening in the places that they leave behind. And is that simply something that they just leave behind and completely forget?
So, Yasmin, let me jump in and
is what I will end with.
So let me jump in and ask the question and just playing devil's advocate. So you have a situation where in pragmatic terms, people aren't going to – I remember a long time ago I was having a discussion with Jerome, actually, McDonald, who's on vacation. And we were having a similar discussion. And I said, well, if a Potawatomi showed up at your house, would you – and claim the land underneath your home, would you leave your home? And he kind of – he didn't answer. But, you know, it gave us both something to think about. And so speaking in pragmatic terms, if Brian trying to come from what he might view, what others might view as a realist perspective about what are the solutions, and he's coming with an economic model, what would – Yasmin, what would you view as sort of a realist solution in dealing with creating, you know, equality or some kind of regime of reparations and such?
So the first thing I would say to you is that the fact that we live in a time where economics is considered realistic, but history is not, right, but in terms of perspective, I'm dumbfounded by that. And especially dumbfounded because, as all of us know, and I think as Brian understands, economics is actually a pretty relatively new discipline. And until fairly recently, in my father's lifetime, for instance, was actually a humanities degree, which has now become a quote-unquote science. So let us not talk about economics as in any way infused with reality. That's one. The second thing is that we think about the prison industrial complex. This is why I keep coming back to the prison industrial complex as an analogy for this, that is useful for this discussion in open borders. When we start to talk about prisons, as many people, Angela Davis, Mariam Kaba, you know, many, most of them black women, I might add, have been talking about prison industrial complex for a very long time. The discussion is now finally coming down to, yes, we wanted to think about reform, but maybe we should really thinking about abolition. And And until even 3 years ago, people were saying that abolition was pie in the sky. What are you, crazy? What are you talking about abolition for? But abolition has now become a way to think about why do we have prisons, which is to say, how do prisons operate to keep fundamental economic, yes, and historical inequalities in place, right?
Certainly, but...
So we don't... I do not want to start discussing about, you know, what would happen if, if a Native American showed up at the door. That is not the issue here. The issue here is how are we to grapple with this enormously complex set of systems that are in place. One way to grapple with them is to say, let's use this moment to simply talk about economic migration as if it's this very simple thing. And just, again, you know, Brian says something about, well, of course, everyone should be allowed to enter. Well, I think Brian knows perfectly well that that is never the case right now, right? No one is saying everyone should be allowed to enter. Everyone is saying, how do we filter?
That is what I'm saying.
Okay, well, we'll give Brian a chance to answer for himself. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess I'm just disappointed that we barely talked about open borders in this radio interview. Again, as I said, the open borders is the idea that everyone should be free to live and work in any country on earth. Of course, there are many arguments against it, and in my work, I try to go over those arguments very patiently just to convince people that, I totally understand why you're worried about the consequences, but the consequences actually on balance are a big improvement for the world, not something that's going to ruin your life.
Okay, and we're going to take a call from Dan. Dan, you're on Worldview.
Hi. So it seems like there's a lot of argument and conflict here, but really everyone agrees on the issue, which is open borders. And I think I'm sorry, I forget his name, but the man talking about the economics is
Brian. Go ahead, Dan.
Yes.
Yeah. In terms of convincing people, that open borders are a good thing. You know, you can talk about the colonialization aspects and all these things, and on an intellectual, academic, moral level, you know, those are good to know and good to learn about and good to understand and appreciate. But when it comes to convincing people here now today, you know, that open borders are a good thing, the economic argument is what resonates. It's what, you know, people vote not on historical colonial grounds, academic grounds. They vote on what's going to affect them and their families here now today, which is why I think, you know, the economic reasons and benefits of open borders are such a powerful aspect of this whole discussion.
Okay, Zay wants to jump in on this one.
Yeah, I mean, let's not forget that indigenous people like the Zapatistas, indigenous people like the Tohono-O'odham Nation, indigenous people like the Diné Nation already have their own networks of commerce, their own networks that do not rely or try not to rely on capitalism in any way, networks of exchange and love and caring for each other that are rooted in the land. So this question about whether a Potawatomi comes over or not, I mean, it's just that's already looking at the land as an object. And I think that we need to rearticulate our position as being one with the land. And truly, the land is for those of us that cultivate the land.
Okay, we're going to take our final break, and then we're going to spend the last few minutes actually being more direct about open borders. I sort of hinted with Zay that we're going to actually land a plane on this one. So please call us, join in, and we're going to have a conversation about open borders. Call us at 312-923-9239. That's 312-923-9239. I'm Steve Bynum. You're listening to Worldview. This is WBEZ.
You're listening to a lively discussion about open borders on Worldview on WBEZ Chicago, and it continues in just a moment. WBEZ is supported by Aurora University, offering online programs in business, computer science, and more. Information available at online.aurora.edu. By Goodman Theater, presenting Support Group for Men, a comedy about a group of middle-aged pals confronting a changing world. The Chicago Tribune says it's laugh-out-loud funny, now playing through July 29th, goodmantheater.org. Worldview on WBEZ is supported by India House. bringing Indian culture to Chicago through authentic Northern Indian cuisine. Multi-course lunch, buffet, and dinner served 7 days a week. India House, located in Chicago and Hoffman Estates. More at IndiaHouse.com. It's 12:46 in 14 minutes, right after Worldview at 1 o'clock. It's Hour 1 of Here and Now.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Imagine you could speak Korean and Mandarin. And French. And that's just the beginning. As our series on language continues, we'll hear from polyglots. That's next time on Here and Now.
Listen in for Here and Now. 2 hours between 1 and 3 o'clock here on WBEZ.
We have a nice day, sunny with a high near 85 today. Also, we're going to have a nice clear night tonight with a low around 65. That's pretty much the pattern through Thursday. Sunny and 81 now at 12:47.
This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Steve Bynum in for Jerome McDonnell, and we're having a very hot discussion about the topic of borders. And we're speaking with Brian Kaplan, professor of economics at George Mason University, Yasmin Nair, who is a historian and a writer for Current Affairs, and Zay, who is a member of the Moratorium to End Deportations campaign. And I want to get to a very pointed and direct question. Zay, I'm going to start with you. So if we have open borders, what does that look like?
Well, fundamentally, it looks like a world without prisons. It looks like a world without borders. It looks like a world without the military. It looks something like the world that indigenous people inhabited before colonization. And I think we fundamentally have to understand that borders and prisons emerge out of colonization and the social death of black people. And I think that America as a house has been stacked as a place of deep despair, of deep trauma. And I think that an open border society is something that we all aspire to, and I'm not sure what it's going to look like.
So beyond a mind exercise, right. What does it look like?
Well, I think it looks very much like what the Tohono O'odham Nation is and has been doing, which is just defying the National Guard. The National Guard has been expanding. Right now, the National Guard is trying to do the search at the southern border. Elbit Systems is trying to put in its towers to be able to track migrants and other undesirable groups. We have drones coming to the border, like Ann Coulter has suggested. I think it looks like what the Tohono O'odham Nation is doing in order to defy the incursion on their lands, and it's something that they've been doing for centuries since, these colonies emerged. And for them, their ancestral practices, okay, where they go worship, where they pray, where they eat, where they go visit their family, their kin, it's on both sides. So they're very fluid, and it wasn't until 1994 that the border was initially militarized. And it's just so interesting that we're talking about economic development and what that looks like in open borders. It's so interesting that when the border was initially closed in that way, militaristically speaking, was 1994, which was the year that NAFTA was passed. And, since then, the Tohono O'odham Nation has done their best to defy this imaginary but very brutal border, mm-hmm, in order to be able to perform ceremony, in order to be able to enact their world vision and their life ways before colonization.
Okay, so obviously militarism is a big part of how you define borders and what it means to you. And so we're going to get to Brian and get his view on this. But first, I want to go to Ashley. Ashley, you're on Worldview.
Hi.
Hi.
So I had a comment, like a comparison of, people are so afraid of what would happen with open borders and the consequences. But, the EU, more or less, the European Union countries have open borders within each other, allowing people to pass without visas, people to work in other countries.
And now you have Brexit as a result, right?
Yeah, but, I think that was more of the populace, like a reaction to the populace being upset. It was a whiplash. You had people the next day, citizens of Britain Googling, what is Brexit? I think it was just a hot-headed reaction, and I think they're truly actually kind of regretting it. But then you have, even just within the United States, like, yes, we're one country, but we have 50 states and how it's set up. You know, I can freely go from here in Chicago to Indiana. I could work there and live here, and it's not an issue. And that's just been extrapolating that to other countries.
Mm. Thanks a lot, Ashley. Really appreciate your call. So, Brian, let's tie that in. I mentioned Brexit and the backlash to the open border system of the European Union. Can you describe, first of all, when you think about open borders, what does that mean?
All right. So, again, like I said, so open borders to me, it just means that people are free to reside and work in any country that they want to on Earth. It's got nothing to do with the military or prisons other than, of course, not putting people in prison for crossing borders, which is the whole heart of the idea. I mean, in terms of, you know, like, you know, to what extent immigration caused Brexit, you know, so, like, you know, the main result here is that the places with the highest foreign-born share in Britain are the ones that are most likely to vote against. So, you know, the main argument to the other side is that places that had a rising amount were more likely to vote for. You know, to me, it just looks like this is just a transition problem where people have trouble dealing with immigrants at first. But once they're around, they see, well, actually, things are pretty much fine. And so, you know, like, you know, there's, you know, you think of it as, you know, growing pains. But, you know, I don't see this as any big argument against open borders.
Yasmin?
Yes, I think, you know, to answer that question, what does open borders look like? What open borders, the concept in real life would look like is that people are, yes, able to migrate across borders, but not without all of us fundamentally, globally, ensuring that the economies that they move from are also healthy, that the places that they live in, that the families that they leave behind or take with them are also fundamentally healthy. And not just, and that is not just a place where elites move across borders, but where everybody is able to move across borders regardless. I would also argue that it's actually not easy for people to migrate across borders in the United States. And I agree in many other ways with the caller who called in, but it's actually not easy for people in Chicago, for instance, to just move across the border to Illinois just to set up. It all depends on racial, gender, economic factors. So I think we really have to think about what migration means and how migration is tied to our statuses as individual human beings and our histories as human beings. That's all I have to say.
Aaron in McHenry County, you're on Worldview.
Hi.
Hi.
How you guys doing?
What's your question or comment, Aaron?
Sure. I was listening to you guys talk about the open borders, and mm-hmm. I was wondering whether or not a U.S. policy of open borders would have an effect on illegal trafficking, whether it be drug trafficking or human trafficking, whatever it might be.
We'll let Brian answer it and Zayo jump in. Brian?
Yeah. So for human trafficking, it would almost get rid of it because one of the main reasons that trafficking exists is because people are trying to illegally cross the border. So if they could just do it with a bus ticket, they're not going to go and put themselves at risk with doing it illegally. In terms of drugs, I guess the main thing to say about that is like when trade is easier, then it's easier to trade legal and illegal things. So probably be a bit more. But again, I don't see that as a huge deal. But again, then we'd have to have a separate discussion of drug policy to really go into it.
So, Brian, you've referenced what the solutions could be, but it's the getting there, that the mm-hmm. missing link for me. And so obviously you have to deal with policy and you have to deal with people mm-hmm. who are trying to get elected to office. You're dealing with political people. There are all sorts of levels to this beyond just simple economics, let more people work. But then what are some of the political changes? What are some of the societal changes that have to happen in order to get to where you want to get?
So I think I want to respond to that. And I think that, you know, it's a really tough question to answer, but I think like it's going to be bloody. Having open borders is going to be a very bloody process because the state is always trying to reify itself and it is always trying to reinvent the subjectivity of the slave. So it is always redesigning its prisons, its borders, its jobs. You know, it's like if we want to talk about human trafficking, let's talk about capitalism. Let's talk about the state. Let's talk about how our children are literally being filtered to detention centers that are now just Walmarts. Let's talk about how the Department of Homeland Security operates ICE, also operates Customs or Border Patrol, how commodities at a Walmart are now the same thing as children from indigenous migrant communities. Let's talk about how, you know, getting to this open border thing is going to be very, very bloody. And I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of legislation going around. You know, I don't think the Bernie Sanders of the world are going to do it. I don't think Elizabeth Warren is going to do it. I think it's going to take indigenous and anarchist praxis, the way that it's always been done, from the Cuban Revolution to the Haitian Revolution to what's happening in places like Ferguson. It's going to be a synthesis between black and brown people and anarchists that are going to fundamentally destroy the social fabric of America.
So before I quickly let Brian answer that question, I would say to you, Zay, then, isn't one of the lessons or what would be said, one of the lessons of the past election process in 2016 is that when people don't participate, when they don't vote, when they're not involved in the political process, then they lose their power, their ability.
Absolutely. I just think that that is just such a dead and tired argument. I'm just so tired.
So how else do you do it if not through the political system?
I can show you, and I've been doing it for about 10 years. You know, today I woke up in a squat in Chicago's West Side. So we take foreclosed homes and we give them to the community. We give them through legal help and through legal means and channels. We give homes to the community. Why? Because those homes are not the banks. They are not America's. Those homes are the people that live there, right? So, you know, for us, this like this question of how we're going to do it. I mean, we've been doing it for 10 years, and it takes having community discussions. You know, today in Little Village, we're going to be hosting a discussion on hashtag Keep Families Together. Is it a solution or is it a crisis? You know, are these organizations like ICER, like OCAD, like the Dreamer narratives that we're being, you know, fed through the mainstream media, are these the narratives, are these the values of our people, or are these values of separation that pit deserving communities against non-deserving communities? And I would invite everyone to come to the Little Village Public Library today, starting at 5:30 until 7:30. Me and the rest of the Moratorium on Deportations campaign will be hosting a community town hall on the issue of the NGO industrial complex, border militarization, and yeah, this issue of open borders.
Okay, thank you, Zay and Brian. Do you have 15 to 20 seconds to wrap?
Yeah, open borders has nothing to do with violence. I don't know. This stuff about things are going to get bloody is completely crazy. I want nothing whatsoever to do with that. You know, like open borders is just about letting people reside and work anywhere they want and doesn't require and should not involve anything involving violence of the kind.
Yasmeen?
Good God.
I think immigration and open borders, it's not a science experiment. You cannot do all of this under closed conditions, the kind that are being discussed by some people. I think we have to understand that actually this idea of history and histories that people are still living is not foreign to most of us who actually have to live them. Those who are privileged enough to forget it are privileged enough to do so. But immigration, open borders, those things are not science experiments. We have to be prepared for a lot of messiness in the years forward.
Yasmeen Nair, Zay, David Kaplan, thank you all for this discussion. Tomorrow on Worldview, we'll be back with a Romanian senator who's going to talk about how populism is sweeping his country and what they're doing about it. I'm Steve Bynum. You've been listening to Worldview on WBEZ.